Welcome everyone to the slowest couple of weeks in crypto art that I can remember. I mean, this is depths of the bear market type quiet, right? Sure, you have a couple of new projects dropping here and there, and I was saddened to see another beloved institution, this time the Red Lion Gazette, shuttering. And these are all worthy of our attention, of course, but when I was putting together today's episode, I couldn't shake this feeling that, for a whole host of reasons, not that much has really been going on at all. We'll talk in more detail during the podcast about how general economics, geopolitical instability, and a post-NFTNYC hangover have contributed to what I've been considering as a lack of excitement or intrigue. But I've learned that there are benefits to these kinds of moments. You remember, surely, the platitudes in which people spoke during the bear market's most doldrum days. Keep building, keep your head down, adjust, pivot, think critically, things like that. Cliché, sure, but not wrong. You aren't usually afforded an opportunity to do any of these things when the space is cranking. Only a few weeks ago, it was base open editions and meme coins and ordinals, bang, bang, bang. Hard to keep up, harder to form a cogent opinion, damn near impossible to draw any larger conclusions. So I'm choosing to view this momentary collective pause as a gift. What can we talk about, think about, and consider in this moment that, when things are crazier and more numbers-oriented, are difficult to get a read on? Today's podcast is very much about making good on the potential of this pause. It's just Colborne and I today, and we're taking stock of what we're calling the state of almost everything in crypto. Crypto art, AI, metaverse, cryptocurrency, and crypto culture. Where are we today? Where are we going? And what will be the impetuses for change in the future? We'll get into all that and more on today's Mocha Live podcast. Please enjoy. Good evening, everyone. It is 6:33 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Welcome to the Mocha Live podcast. If you've been following along with the Mocha Live podcast for the last 30 minutes, we couldn't get this thing to start. We had some problems on the back end, technical difficulties. They seem to be alleviated. We have an audience. We have a co-host. We have I guess we're both co-hosts. We have a host and a co-host. You can choose for yourself which is which, but my name is Max Cohen. My name is Max Cohen. I will be one of your hosts today. And joining me for the Mocha Live podcast, my trusty co-host, as always, that's Mr. Colborne Bell. What is up,
Colborne? It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here. I'm glad we figured this all out.
We figured it out. We did it. We are back for the Mocha Live podcast. We are happy to have everyone with us. Thanks for your patience. If you're just joining us for the first time, welcome. If you're a repeat offender, we are happy to have you back with us. We're going to jump right into the podcast today, so you might notice something a little bit different. And Akuchi, Colborne's cat, does not count for what I'm about to say.
But he's always here.
He's always here. We don't count him as a guest. And in fact, this is the first episode of Mocha Live since January, where it's just been Colborne and I, which is very exciting. So nice to just be the boys back in the saddle again.
Yeah, we're shooting it. We're shooting it live.
We're shooting it live. We're doing it live. And as we always like to do when it's just us at this point, we wanted to make this episode a little special, a little different, and also a little retrospective. So we have another Mocha podcast. It's called Mokna or Mokya. Every couple of weeks or so, we break down current events, big news, that sort of thing. But today on Mocha Live, we kind of just wanted to pause, right? And take a look at where are we right this second. And it feels to me like a pretty good time to do that, right? It's been a crazy week. Financially, geopolitically, there's a flood in Dubai and a lot of crypto people are stuck there in the endless floodwaters. It's funny, but it's also not funny.
No, it was not funny. Yeah.
So, you know, and then on top of that, NFT NYC was a couple of weeks ago. And I think it's pretty normal that after these big conferences, people kind of like go into social hiding for a second. Maybe they had like big exhibitions or art pieces they were revealing. And now they're kind of like back in the trenches. So I think the best thing to do today is to take this moment to take stock of kind of all the things going on in the wider crypto art world. So we're going to break today's podcast into five segments: crypto art, AI, the metaverse, cryptocurrency in general, and crypto culture. And for each category, we've written down kind of a fundamental question about what's going on right now in the hopes that we can come to a kind of cohesive conclusion about like the state of all these things right now, where they're going, etc. So this is an ambitious, you know, really highbrow podcast, and I think we should just jump right in. What do you think, Colborn?
I'm ready for it. Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to start with crypto art, right? Crypto art. You know it. We know it. We love it. You love it. The question on my mind for crypto art right now, and we've been talking about this for a couple of days, that it just kind of seems like, and this happens every couple of months, that there's just not electricity right now. Not that there's not stuff happening. There's been wonderful drops. I know Travis Leroy Southworth just had a drop on Ordinals today. There's fantastic art all over the place. But when are things going to move? When are things going to advance in a direction that feels substantial? And so my question, the kind of underlying level of this, is when are we going to figure out the display problem? And can it be fixed at all?
Ooh.
Because to me, that feels like the most prescient issue in crypto art right now.
Yeah, display. Like, can we bring these into our homes? Can we bring these onto our screens? How do we begin to share and express what we've been collecting? It's difficult, man. I think we've spent numerous years within the museum trying to build out this curation technology, trying to bring it both into people's homes via Mocha Show, trying to bring these into like metaverse environments via the room technology that we've put forth. And, you know, it makes you wonder if at this state that people really care about what they've collected. If it's, you know, I think there was a tweet from Colin saying there's maybe about 20 people spending over $200 in crypto art. Has this been sidelined to being such a niche as to like render it irrelevant? I think we all recognize the growth, like the potential growth, the potential recognition that all content online identity, and that is very, very tenuous. It's a very tenuous value proposition at this stage. Mm-hmm. And it exists amidst a very fragmented social media landscape.
And even broader than just like the social media, or like bring this into our homes, right? Like, we've had this problem for a while where crypto art is just appealing to crypto art, right?
Yeah.
And the more time goes on, because I think that the common knowledge and the way it's been presented to me is like, oh, all these things, the crypto art, the NFTs, all this stuff that's going on, like as a subunit of cryptocurrency at large, like what we're really waiting for is mass adoption of crypto. Once there's mass adoption of crypto, then the attention will come down the pipeline. And I'm not sure that that's actually the way that this is going to go. You know, we saw the Bitcoin ETF launch and a ton of money flowed into Bitcoin, and maybe it trickled down to some other like altcoins. But really what we're seeing is like, the next level of investor in the space has far more options than they did in 2021, 2020 to invest in crypto in a way that they don't have to be on crypto Twitter. They don't have to like involve themselves with the rest of crypto. You can perfectly fine. And this is only going to get more expansive as more ETFs come out, as there are more kind of like top level Coinbase proffered ways of touching crypto, but not being within crypto. And like, we can look at the, you know, Xcopy Neon Glitch 86 Mutatio thing. We can look at that and say, oh, look, there's a million editions minted, right? With, you know, tens of thousands of wallets. But it doesn't matter for the greater landscape unless you are getting down to the nexus, right? We no longer want people who are just on Ethereum or just on Solana or just here. We want people who are kind of just within this NFT nexus from which they can then branch out into all the different chains, into all these different art styles. They can start to get a sense of what's going on here. But it's easier and easier to not do that. And I think that that's really the difficulty. How does this factor into the display discussion? Well, that's the way of getting what's going on here out of the crypto Twitter bubble and into the real world. We've both been on record as saying, like, you know, putting your art on a billboard in Times Square is not good enough, right? That is not going to get people to have a personal stake in your art, in our art movement. And until we figure out this display issue, until we figure out a way to get crypto art ownable by people and then like portable in, like, again, into their homes, not even into their homes, but just like, you know, onto their phone backgrounds in an easy way, in a way that can change with their tastes, into screens that they can have in their homes, like in the screens that they're seeing all around. This problem doesn't go away and we remain within this echo chamber.
I think it's super prudent, Max. You know, what is the point? It feels like, what is the point unless people can continue to show it off?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are certain market stars in which attention is accumulating to, in which markets are tightening. I think, like, by large, that is, you know, if your name is not XCopy, it's a really brutal market for you. And I think we all hope that, you know, the proceeds kind of like flow downhill, that people are interested in discovery, that people are interested in curation, that people are interested in like pushing their tastes into this. But at the same time that we're experiencing incredible dilution, we're not experiencing incredible expansion.
But it's also, yeah, I don't mean to cut you off, but like, no, this is also an XCopy problem, right? It's awesome that people like, you know, Cosmo and Moderats are buying these XCopy works at huge prices. It's awesome that these things are like being seen as holding cultural value. But like, you can't have this in a museum because like, you're not just going to buy the display problem exists there too. Unless you're a Rafik Anadol who can have these incredible displays because you have so much money into just your work. Like, even then you have your one work at MoMA, your work at like these kind of like art houses throughout the world. Like, you know, you buy Moderats buys an XCopy for $900,000. There's obviously a assumption that the price of that, the asset is going to, the price is going to intensify over time, but that can't happen if more people aren't being exposed to that art, if it's not becoming more widely culturally significant, right? It's great to own a Warhol, but unless everyone knows who Warhol is, the thing is capped at its possible value.
I'm like super of the opinion that unless we grow the base of the pyramid, that nothing at the top retains that value. And I really truly believe that in a emergent age of the intersection of blockchain and AI, that the scarcity of one of one at the top of the pyramid will be driven by like the collective consensus of the people participating at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't own any dollar flies and I don't own any mutatios. And, but as kind of like a holder of XCopy, you definitely want to see a broader consensus at the bottom agreeing that this is something that is important. It's something incredibly like culturally relevant. And I agree with that. Like, this is crypto art at its core. It holds symbolic relevance that needs to be appreciated and it deserves to be valued. And, you know, I don't want to be so trite as to kind of condense it into one name. It's a responsibility of everybody that like exists at the top to also consider what is happening at the bottom of their pyramid.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, like this kind of innovation benefits everyone top to bottom in the pyramid. I guess I just feel like, you know, we're almost like playing a game of hot potato. And when all of this display technology becomes, in theory, if it becomes available, and I want to say if and not when, because I don't see it as an eventuality, right? It needs to be widespread enough that and accessible enough and intelligently designed enough. But if it can become available, then whoever is the XCopy at that moment, they become the XCopy, so to speak, permanently, right? It may not be XCopy. You know, we had this whole thing with Dmitry Cherniak and the Goose last summer, and it was like, oh no, Dmitry Cherniak is the voice that's going to come out of crypto art. And then the Monument game happened. It was Sam Spratt who's the voice that's going to come out of crypto art. Now it's XCopy. And XCopy's the one, the savior, right? And it will continue to change and it will continue to shift hands, probably within a small and predictable group. But whoever's able to hold that potato at the time at which these things can expand into larger cultural value and be seen by a much larger cultural audience. That's who's actually going to come out of this movement. I'm using come out. You see, get what I mean. I'm not like saying that you can't, there's not a bridge between, but that those will be the people that attain the seismic widespread cultural value that they are a household name everywhere. But until this technology develops, nobody can be. And that caps where everything can go. And because it caps the top, it caps the bottom. And so anyways, that's my...
It's about access, right? I think you're speaking to a very, very intelligent point about how do people begin to access and participate. And, you know, if this is only people that have their MetaMask wallets that are competent to bridge assets over to requisite chains that, you know, are able to engage in a value exchange that exists only within crypto, well, it's a very, very small limited segment of the population, but there is incredible future potential for us to escape out of that and to escape in a like a scarcity-based economic dynamic in which there are effectively more dollars hunting for rare cultural assets. You know, a million in the scape in the landscape of 8 billion people is tiny, right? And a million in the landscape of 8 billion people plus 10 billion, 100 billion autonomous agents is really tiny. But what are people doing to kind of like showcase? What are the options for people to begin to like bring and incorporate and share? I think going back to the original point of, you know, what is the display technology available? It's limited, or people conceive it to be limited, or people are taking a speculation bet where they can buy something for, you know, $4 and sell it for $10. I'm very curious in a down market or in a range bound market like we're in currently to see what the potential for like value appreciation for these assets really is.
Me too. Let's move on to our next category, because I fear we could talk about this first one all day.
100%.
Next category, what is the state of AI today? And I want to come at this through a very specific lens, because obviously these are all topics that we could spend 5 podcasts on a piece. And this is inspired by an article from The Atlantic that said, AI has lost its magic, by Ian Bogost. And the basic tenor of the article is that when ChatGPT was released last year, it was just a fervor, right? People were using this in all facets of life. They were experimenting with it. It was also like fun and impressive. And people like were just sharing the crazy things that you could do with AI. Those crazy things are still here, but there's not nearly as much in the public discourse of a luster around AI. And my question to determine the state of AI is, what recaptures the public attention in AI? There's the idea that it could be, you know, OpenAI's Sora, right? The video generation, when that happens, that it may like bring the average, bring the layperson back to being blown away by AI technology. My question to you is, what do you see? And then also, like, is it even necessary to get the general public back excited about AI?
Well, I think all of these things start at a speculation standpoint, right? We're all trying to determine where we are going, what is valuable in the future, right? So you look at proxy signals like NVIDIA, AMD, SMCI, you see them also equally range bound. And, you know, when the greatest advocates for your project are always the people that are making money off of your project, right? And in the case of like speculation and people that are like, you know, buying calls, we have a incredibly like addictive economy that has developed. And I truly generally believe that the younger generation is like hoping and betting on a future that they want to see I would have done the same if I was in my like early 20s, and that manifests itself in, you know, either meme coins and like betting on cultural speculation, or on, you know, like growth stocks that they believe encompasses their values. And it's certainly difficult to reconcile all the change that is occurring, all of the things that people want to see, and where we are currently. It's very, very much a battle. I think we are in the depths of the bear market, right? And you see a lot of confusion, you feel a lot of uncertainty, you feel a lot of people wondering what the economic benefits are to them. You know, we're a couple days outside of the halving of Bitcoin, and this is just a, you know, I don't want to say it's a critical moment, I don't want to say it's a pivotal moment, but it's, you know, you're dealing with major long-term societal trends that are going to have vast implications over our lifetimes, trying to play themselves out in real time in the short term. Yeah, and betting on those implications is a very, very difficult and nuanced game.
There's a, I think it's called Rabbit. And it's like, it's a product, it's hardware, it's something you could buy. It's like an AI assistant, basically, or like the precursor to an AI assistant. And you know, I had read this Atlantic article, and I found it very compelling. And the writer was talking about how interesting and incredible it was when ChatGPT first came out to be able to like write a poem about anything in the style of anyone. But by now, like the use of that has worn off, right? The novelty is off, and there's really no greater use, right? Like maybe you are in school and you're using ChatGPT to write an essay, but the practical applications for the layperson of integrating AI into their lives is still fairly weak, right? It's going to be back end and all, you know, all these things. It'll help with search engines. It will help with databases. It'll help in business and economics and such. But the layperson does not really have a reason to use AI on a daily basis. And even me, like I use ChatGPT every day, but really, really limited use cases, right? It's just like when I'm writing certain things and don't want to like go researching for, you know, very precise information. And I kind of think that like the ways in which AI will evolve need to meet like just an average person's daily needs who are not interfacing with AI in its own focused area, right? We don't want people, it's not about people going to, you know, OpenAI and using their products. It's not about, you know, people generating art with this stuff. It's about like, knowing that, you know, an AI that's going to know your grocery list, order it for you, and you can just set and forget it, right? And you have this program that maybe you've fine-tuned, but you're having just groceries appear on your doorstep every week that are a little bit different based on the changing seasons, based on your taste, like things of that nature, right? And it seems like we're still a long way off from that because the AI is not good enough. And like it has it integrated into businesses in that way. But I see that as kind of the only real thing that will start to like revitalize public attention. What were you going to say?
No, I think that's right. I think how do we begin to interface and incorporate these, this intelligence, this idea of intelligence into daily life? And unless it is in ways that you are suggesting, I think whether it's grocery delivery, whether it's recommendations for consumption, it's not certainly not going to be tailored to means in which we can grow personally, right? It is controlled, it is biased, it is going to serve the needs of the people that are offering it to us. Right. And at this point, it is requiring a tremendous amount of computational power, computational expertise, knowledge of data and preferences that very few corporations own. So how we begin to like influence and move these biases, it all feels a little bit like we are continually to be stuck in the same exercise with little hope of independence. And I don't know if that is inherently a bad thing if, you know, we are constantly trading like value for convenience, right? And do we provide like more value in a digital landscape than the conveniences that are being afforded to us, where we can afford to like participate in grocery selection, and that it knows like which meals we should be cultivating for ourselves? It's then who this data ultimately flows to. Mm-hmm. It's hard because you end up in the same trap of like Meta, Google, Microsoft, like, and then you begin to wonder if there is any room for mobility, if there is any room for personal growth, or if we are all beholden to these digital algorithms that dictate for us what is best for us.
And that's not necessarily a deal breaker either, because I think that, like, you know, you have Microsoft AI and that flows downstream to Bethesda, and Bethesda makes video games, and then suddenly you're playing a video game that is like, it makes itself perfect based on your tendencies. Like, there are ways that this can like appeal to, you know, us at the very bottom of this, you know, food pyramid, but each step at which this thing is gatekept, and each new like organization into which, you know, AI information, AI possibilities flow, you get more and more of a bottleneck in terms of what the like outputs, not the like the cultural outputs, are going to be able to be. So I guess my point overall is that, like, for a moment there, it seemed like AI was going to be in all of our lives in every single way immediately. And I don't feel as much like that these days. I feel like it's going to take some more time for the technology itself to integrate, like you said, into corporations, top end entities, in a way that they can kind of like manipulate for their own purposes. Well, and then there's another huge gap of time before that flows back down to the consumer, the layperson, whatever you want to call it. We're going to be receiving enough tangible benefits from AI technology that they'll be like, oh yeah, this is exciting. This is now a part of my life that I want, need, crave, etc.
I've gotten to this point in my life where you just have to kind of like trust the markets as aggregates of perfect information, right? Mm-hmm. Where everything kind of flows into them. And the fact of the matter is that like NVIDIA, AMD, SMCI, they've all kind of stalled out at this point, which is, it's a major question mark on what the acceptance of our collective human future will be. And
I don't Ayn Rand over here.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have, you know, as an individual, I don't have the answer. It is a collective question. I think generally people lean into acceptance, but you know, you can feel it. I can certainly feel the tension that exists today in the market between the people that are incumbents and want to maintain their power and are pushing towards like a decade long career growth, and the people that are looking to revolution, have some sort of revolution and power within the system. Yeah. There is a marked difference between those who want to maintain the status quo and those who are looking to like uplift this technology and incorporate it into something that might empower individuals. It's just, how does that newfound power begin to upset the status quo, and where does value transfer in the interim?
Well said. Let's move on to category three, shall we?
Yeah, please.
Don't be so excited, because we're going to talk about the state of the metaverse. And my underlying question for this, my organizing principle, is, will Apple own the metaverse on sheer vibes? Why do I say that? Well, the metaverse is kind of like, it doesn't matter where you look, there is not just like much. I mean, you can look within crypto art, these like little niche communities, your M3s, your Decentralands, your, you know, Nifty Islands, plenty of incredible builders building incredible things. But at a larger cultural level, the only new and exciting thing in any of the metaverse adjacent realms, whether that's virtual worlds, AR, VR, et cetera, all Apple, right? The Vision Pro, which I've gotten a chance to play with, which we've talked about quite a few times in the podcast, is the only real revolution in anything metaverse adjacent, like real, like widespread cultural tendrils that I've seen, period. And Apple certainly seems like they are going to make their big bet on VR goggles, and then all the things that come out of that will follow. But everyone else, especially the FANG companies, are just uninterested. I mean, Facebook like turned tact. They like divested themselves of the metaverse. They lost like $40 billion in 2 years after they changed their name to Meta. And they were the big metaverse company, right? And now it's Apple as like a part of its business model, a part of its business model that they don't really need to like generate a ton of profit, which is the scary part, right? In the same way that like all these large companies, your Amazons and your Apples, you know, invented streaming services into themselves, but they don't really need these streaming services to do anything. They don't need them to generate money. You know, Disney is faltering with their streaming service, Disney Plus. Netflix is the only one that's able to like maintain actual valuation. You know, CBS with CBS All Access or Paramount, and then fucking Peacock on NBC, like all of them are money sinks. And they're money sinks for Apple and Amazon too, but they don't care because they have this incredible business elsewhere. So into this walks the metaverse, and Apple's going to be able to put a massive amount of resources, a massive amount of research and development that nobody else is going to be able to do, and they have a head start. So if they're 6 years ahead of all of their competition, and they're going to start coming out with these products, they're going to be able to stranglehold this market in a way that I'm not even sure that they were able to necessarily do with the iPhone, right? And that's, it's not a fear, it's not an excitement, it's just a notion. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I would fight back on the notion that Meta's expenditures in the idea of the metaverse have been a total and complete failure, because I think the stock price would indicate differently. And I think that, you know, again, I'm going to lean into the fact that like the market is always right. And I truly believe this was my thesis for getting into crypto to begin with. Is that like the aggregate opinion of all of the people involved in these things is much more stronger than anybody's personal opinion. So I think, you know, we have to contend with the idea that there is a future in which the majority of human existence is lived online through digital and virtual environments. And through that, we have to wonder what it means for like state of commercial real estate, or what it means for like the state of human interaction, and what it means for the idea of the third place in American society being in a kind of like a neutral place where people get together and they gather and they share the experiences, the lived experiences that they have. And like societally, traditionally, these places have been in bars, alcohol has been kind of at the center. And I think for people in their 20s, and I think there's a realization amongst people in their 30s that there is a desire to shift away from this as like a center and emerge into something new. Now, whether we find that connection online or if we're able to like recreate those environments in our spaces, in our communities, in physicality with one another is very, very important, because I think after COVID, we recognized that something was inherently broken, that we, you know, there was certainly the realization that we were not connecting with our fellow persons. But I think inherently this is like an evolutionary desire to be involved, to be connected, to see things through. And I fight a lot recently with like the speed and the demand and the desire to get things done from the younger generation. And I kind of sit on the bridge of this with like the recognition that physicality takes time, like the transition into new modes and models takes time. And the translation into physical environments also takes time. So I see it happening. I'm like in a place where this is experiencing both like a tremendous fight between what was and what could be and how we realize these dreams, like concerts and communication and coordination. And it's all to say that I think that like the digital manifestations are occurring first, and they are translating into physical manifestations, and we are just kind of pushing these things outward beyond us. Although we have to recognize that like the life lived inherently online is not sufficient, and it needs to push into kind of like broader society.
I love where you brought that. And I think that honestly, like, we don't need to say much more. So let's just move on. Category number four, cryptocurrency. Perhaps you've heard of it. Let's talk about the state of it. You may have just like, if you're listening, watching, or whatever, you're probably recognizing a trend right now, which is a lot of like the why or how are people en masse going to be interested in this? And I think the cryptocurrency question is really interesting, especially with what we've seen in the last couple of months with meme coins. So my underlying question is there a reason for the layperson to own cryptocurrency beyond hoping the value increases?
I would say undoubtedly yes. I mean, you know, certainly from the everyday participant, we're a little bit in what I would call like range bound and down. We're stuck. We're stuck in a holding pattern. It's been this way for 3-4 months, you know, from I think it was October to December, we experienced a 50% rise in the price of Bitcoin, 40 to 60,000 on the back of the ETFs. You know, this is real mainstream institutional adoption. This is a big hype moment. This is a point for, you know, all of the wealth managers to begin to say that this is an accessible product for people that hold portfolios and that you could use this in, you know, as an inflation hedge, right? And there's numerous macroeconomic indicators that suggest that Bitcoin is becoming that hedge against inflation. Now, you know, as much as I was extolling markets for being perfect earlier, This is an instance where like markets are not perfect.
Ayn Rand is dead.
Yeah, I don't feel that that the price of Bitcoin is like inherently baked in, but there's also people like looking to escape tax consequences for being in GBTC, Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, looking to escape the 1.5% fees, moving into other products. They're selling, there's buying. We're finding an equilibrium. We are certainly range bound. We are 2-3 days from the halvening. And this is a product that over time has proven itself resilient to whatever happens. It is emergent as the world's currency. And that is a value proposition that extends far beyond its current price of whatever it is, $62,000. And I would like to believe on top of that like everything is of cascading benefit from there.
I definitely didn't give enough thought in this question to this idea of hedging against inflation, which is something that I think we are all aware of. But I know that like my American minded perspective, I too often forget, you know, our friends in Argentina, the global South, especially, but these countries that are, you know, have a massive amount of just like economic instability, owning a crypto is way safer for like holding on to value of money than holding one's own currency. You know, I don't go in much for the kind of conspiratorial side of it. I recognize this idea that like if you have money in banks that they are going to be able to control your money, and that has potentially negative consequences. But I think for 99% of people that will never be a problem. Maybe not as high as 99, but maybe, you know, 95% of people, they will never have a problem working with banks on taking their money out. There will never be a reason for anyone to doubt their transactions, and they just kind of want to like do their thing, make their money, take it out, go on with their merry day. But for way more people, right, way higher, way lower than 95% of people, like rapid manic inflation is a huge problem. And I think I certainly forget that living in the US, where it's a problem, but, you know, a 4% problem and not like, you know, a 20 to 30% problem. Yeah. And especially, you know,
100 plus percent problem.
Like, I don't think that it's prudent to like get into too large a discussion about geopolitics on this podcast, because I certainly am not an expert, but I can recognize like mass instability when I see it. And if you're a person living in the Middle East, for example, where there's just all this instability going on, if you are, you know, who knows how this ends up affecting relationships between like the NATO countries and the BRICS countries, there is just political instability. And especially if countries are going to be divesting themselves of the United States dollar en masse as like the de facto currency, well, that's going to contribute to all sorts of wonky things that I am probably unaware of in any more specific tones, if you're using this currency as your baseline currency. And yeah, having a global currency that is not, like we've said forever, right? Like everyone said, maybe I haven't internalized, like having a currency that is not tied to the, you know, tenor and relevance and power of a nation state. Well, that's not great when your nation state is the most powerful in the world, but as it stops, as that role ceases to describe the place, probably want to think more critically and like you said, hedge against the possible negative effects of that. And Bitcoin's the way to do it.
I will just say, if you, as somebody who is primarily a writer, a creative, are able to come to these conclusions, then it's very interesting to me, as somebody who like has studied economics, that like you're so deep in this understanding that it's hopeful. I don't know what to say other than that, like, you have described it so succinctly and so beautifully.
Well, thanks.
And so from the outside, that we certainly have a currency problem, in that it represents like ideologies that perhaps no longer are relevant in a globalized society.
Well, I appreciate the kind words. Don't ask me to answer any more questions or go any deeper than
this. That's where my melody
will end.
Yeah, all right. Nice.
Let's end with our last category is crypto culture, which, you know, touches everything we talked about before, but I think is also kind of swirls around over and below everything. Crypto culture is obviously a pretty amorphous term, but you know it when you see it. My underlying question for crypto culture is this: will we have a unified crypto culture, right? There is a crypto culture, right? And you can have substratas of that, but there's really just the one culture and they all kind of touch each other. My question is, will this unified crypto culture ever split so fully into subcultures where the subcultures are more intermingled with the worlds they purport to exist in than with crypto culture at large? And that was a word soup. So I just want to explain that a little bit more,
yeah.
Which is like, take crypto art culture. It has a lot more to do with the art world than it does with crypto on its face, right? And most people who are creating art here care more about art than they do about crypto. Theoretically, that chasm only widens over time, right? Where crypto art is seen not as a substrata of cryptocurrency, but as a substrata of the art world, right? And like collectible NFT, PFP, Top Shot, whatever you want to call it, that world is a substrata of the collectible world more than is a substrata of cryptocurrency. And cryptocurrency culture itself, a substrata of finance culture, which is really what it is. So, you know, again, no preference here, not good nor bad, but like, will these things ever split up so fully that they belong to their own worlds more than they belong to each other?
Yeah, it's really difficult, because there is an inherent value proposition here, right? And that digital art deserves the ability to be traded freely in these terms amongst people that are voluntarily participating in this market. And there's a lot of philosophical implications of this that exist outside of probably the realm of what would be considered normality, which makes me want to kind of like stamp it with a capital A art and scream to the world that like crypto art is emergent and this is everything. And this is like going to be the most beautiful like value appreciation ever, because there is inherent scarcity in what is being provided. And scarcity is what is lacking in this world today, of almost like unlimited dollar printing, of right, like rampant inflation. It all goes hand in hand. But you know, at the same time, the niche is so small. It's a question of like, who cares about art? Who cares about emergent art? Who has the potential and power to shine the light in these far off, strange places? I know a tremendous amount of people are fighting for that spotlight, and it's just hard, right? You cannot shine in a niche the light that deserves everybody.
I guess it requires cryptocurrency in general, and I guess more broadly blockchain technology, becoming so baseline integrated into life in general that it is no longer remarkable enough to hold onto a cohesive culture. Yeah. That it's just so normalized, so widespread to be trading, buying, selling, owning digital assets using blockchain technology that, you know, the people who are owning Bitcoin don't really have anything to do with people who are, you know, buying and selling Fortnite skins, buying and selling, you know, Vipe avatars, right? They're just using the same technology, but the worlds don't exist. So I guess maybe that's the answer to the question fully, is like, crypto culture can't really change until there's such, and who knows when this happens, such widespread crypto adoption. And by that, I mean blockchain adoption, that it's just in everything. And just like the internet itself, right? Like there is no longer just a internet culture, right? Like there was when the internet was first blossoming, and there were like, you know, your couple of chat boards and your couple of websites, and they all kind of borrowed from each other, and it was all the same people kind of talking to each other on each. It just became so ingratiated into everything that you could just use, you know, AOL for your news and have no concept of what was going on like, you know, chatboard X. So perhaps, yeah, what were you gonna say?
Well, I know, you know, I think only to piggyback on what you've been saying is that like we've moved so far beyond like you've got mail, we've moved into the area of like you've got an offer. And like, unfortunately, like you've got an offer in this day and age is a scam. But in the future, it just might not be, right? It might be that like the random messages that you receive online are valid indications of some sort of monetary interest in the work that you've done previously. It's no, in my mind, different than kind of an airdrop, in that like everything is on chain and everybody's trying to bootstrap new things. But I think that everything that is done today inherently carries value into the future. And we're
ever the optimist, Mr. Colborne Bell.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, we're dealing with a future in which, you know, beyond like human participation, there is the promise of a multitude of general intelligence, of artificial general intelligence, in which these things are kind of like filling the gap. And I can only imagine that there is a need to fill the cultural gap.
This is not part of my notes or anything, and we should probably finish up, but I said this question pop in my mind when you said artificial general intelligence. If you're an artist 20 years from now and you create art that people don't like, but the AGI likes, right? The artificial general intelligence is like, this is the shit. People en masse don't really get it, or vice versa. What's your preference as an artist?
Woof. Well, you know, the general intelligence is only acting on previous data points. So I would imagine, you know, in a world of 100 million cultural bots, that the 1 million X copy mutatios are inherently desirable, right? Or if there's a billion, right, autonomous bots out there trying to like collect and read information and trying to distill data that is in front of them and is following trends that there is going to be some sort of momentum around the objects that have captured, you know, relate, like, if I've learned anything, it's that there is an incredible persistence in the networks that are created today, and they continue on into the future, and that exists both through human activation and algorithmic and bot activation.
Well, I hit you with the I don't have an answer to that question. I'm not going to try and answer it myself.
Yeah,
I just popped in the old noggin.
It's just not. I don't know. You know, maybe you can just like. You know, I don't know. Say you were there. It's kind of an existential question of the Museum of Crypto Art itself. It's like, what is the value in saying that you were there at a time when there were so few participants? It must mean something.
I only hope so.
Yeah. I don't know. Or it doesn't. Or it means nothing. And
it was the friends we made along the way, wasn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. It's just really, really interesting.
Absolutely. This has been a fun podcast, Colborne. I'm glad we got to do this. I'm glad we finally got our tech working. I'm glad we got to talk about the state of almost everything. Any last words before we get on out of here?
No, I'm appreciative for the time and the space. These are, these are like moments in time. Everything is so inherently precious. So I'm grateful.
I literally do this for the one in every like 7 or 8 episodes where you're like, wow, that was a really prescient, beautiful point. I'm so proud of you.
Yeah. Likewise, you know, this is, it has become a form of therapy in an illogical and inconsistent world.
Welcome to therapy, everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, so long from therapy. Well, let's get out of here. This has been the State of Almost Everything Mocha Live Super Special Super Show. I'm Max. That's Colborne. If you liked what you heard today and you really want to listen to this episode back, you can do so. Maybe you're listening to it for the first time, but you can do so at Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. You can also collect this episode as an NFT on Zora. Thanks to our friends at Zora for allowing us to do that. I mean, allowing us to do that in a general sense. We don't need anybody's permission to mint this. Anyways, we also appreciate if you check out our Substack. That's museumofcrypto.substack.com. I just wrote a newsletter today on Top Shot, which I promise is not only here to make you laugh, but actually has some interesting stuff going on. But don't take my word for it. Check out the Substack. Like I said, my name is Max. That's Colborne. It's been a pleasure having our therapy session in public live for everyone with us. And we're thankful for you being here. So we'll hope that you're here with us again real soon. Colborne, take care. Everyone else, take care.
Thanks, everybody.
This podcast was edited and produced by me, Max Cohen. A big thanks to Colborne Bell for being my co-host today. A big thanks to Julian Brangold for composing our intro and outro music. And a big thanks to Dayfox for composing our cold open theme. As always, though, our biggest thanks goes out to you, our listener. That's right, you. We really appreciate you being here with us for another Mocha Live podcast episode, and we sincerely hope you'll be with us for the next one. So we'll see you then. So long.